Coming up is the news.
Iran's army kicks off three-day military exercises in a massive stretch of water from the Strait of Hormuz toward the north of the Indian Ocean. Iraqi Prime Minister unhurt that after a drone attack targeted his residence in what his office is saying was an attempt to assassinate the official. And Israel opposing the reopening of the U.S. consulate for Palestinians in the occupied Al-Quds. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Vahram Sanjafi. Good to have you with us. The Iranian army has staged a massive maneuver in the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. The winter exercise is aimed at boosting coordination among the four branches of the Iranian military. Yusuf Jalali has a report.
A full-scale war in the Strait of Hormuz, the Sea of Oman, and north of the Indian Ocean has engaged the Iranian army's navy, air force, air defense, and ground force. This is the scenario of a large-scale military exercise dubbed Zulfaqar 1400. Conducted over a million square kilometer area, the maneuver saw the use of domestically built sea-launched cruise missiles, air-to-surface missiles, and submarines.
The main objective of the drill is to prove that we can stand on our feet and ensure the security of our country and the region. Our message to the foreign forces is that we don't need you here in our region, and regional states have the capability to guarantee their own security.
The three-day drill also involved the latest domestically built drones, such as Simorgh and Muhajir 4, which conducted reconnaissance and combat operations against mock enemy vessels. Iranian military officials boast the country's capabilities in indigenizing the defense industry, and say they owe this to four decades of U.S. arms embargoes that have blocked Iran's access to international defense equipment.
All of the equipment used in the drill, especially those that belong to the Navy, are produced domestically by our experts. Today we successfully tested some of the latest ones in the military exercise, and this shows that with or without U.S. arms sanctions, Iran's borders are safe with our homegrown weapons.
The Army says the drill aims to test the country's indigenously built equipment and to improve its prowess in safeguarding its territorial waters amid heightened tensions in the region, which recently saw Iran showing the footage of its commandos thwarting an attempt by the U.S. Navy to seize an Iranian oil tanker in the Sea of Oman.
One of the major goals of this maneuver is to boost synergy and coordination between the four branches of the Iranian Army, a goal which the Army says is not a threat to any country, but a contributor to peace and security in a region that's rife with piracy and extraterritorial threats. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Now moving on to Iran, saying that the U.S. cannot carry on with its failed maximum pressure campaign and economic terrorism against it while claiming to seek negotiations and an agreement at the same time. In a phone call with his Chinese counterpart, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian expressed hope that the U.S. and Europeans would take a realistic approach to the upcoming talks in Vienna so that a deal could be achieved swiftly. Wang Yi also said that the U.S. is chiefly to blame for the embattled status of the 2015 nuclear deal. He hoped that the U.S. would make amends by removing all anti-Iran sanctions. The top Iran diplomat also had a phone conversation with his Russian counterpart. Amir Abdollahian said that Iran would return to full compliance with the agreement if the U.S. fully implemented its obligations and refrained from making demands outside the scope of the deal. He, however, pointed to the recent U.S. sanctions against Iran's drone program, saying that Iran is skeptical about Washington's motives. Sergei Lavrov also said that all sides should resume implementing the deal, with the U.S. having to do so first. The political commentator Tony Gosling says Washington must re-enter the Iran nuclear deal by removing sanctions against the country.
The United States always seems to be trying to squeeze more out of this apple, more juice than is actually in there. What they do, I mean, they do this many times. And I remember a couple of years ago, the Russian President Vladimir Putin saying that the United States is not deal ready. It's basically saying that if you're sitting down to try and negotiate, in a way, you're wasting your time. Now, I think, you know, this is what we have to do. You've got to always try and negotiate. But it was really a great breakthrough for the world when the JCPOA was signed by President Obama back in 2015 with Iran. And this, what it did is it blocked out the Israelis. The Zionists really want to actually start conflict in the Middle East in order to drag the Americans in into the Middle East. So what needs to happen is the United States must go back, re-sign the deal with all of the other participants. As the sanctions begin to be lifted around the world against Iran, so that seems to be obvious. A child can see that that is what needs to happen if the US is serious about this deal. As Biden promised last year before he was elected, that he would re-sign this deal and he would put it back together.
The Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi says that he's unhurt after a drone attack targeted his residence in Baghdad's Green Zone.
Thank God, me and those who work with me are in good health. Your heroic security and military forces are working on maintaining Iraq's stability and protection. The cowardly missiles and the cowardly drones do not build our nation and do not build our future. We are working on building our nation, on respecting the state and its establishments, securing better future for all Iraqis.
Al-Kadhimi is calling on Iraqi citizens to remain calm and maintain peaceful dialogue for the sake of their country and future. The attack has injured several members of his personal protection team as well. Iraq has seen some turmoil following last month's general elections. There have been protests over the election results. The latest protests in Baghdad just 2 days ago turned out of control, and one person was killed. Now, following that, Al-Kadhimi ordered a committee to investigate the violence. So far, there's been no claim of responsibility for that attack on the premier's house. The Iraqi military, however, is saying it was an attempt to assassinate him. Now, stay with the same story about the failed attempt on the life of the Iraqi prime minister. Reactions from different groups and officials are now coming in. President Barham Saleh saying that attempted assassination was a heinous crime against Iraq. Meantime, cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, whose party won a majority in the October controversial parliamentary vote, has called the attack an act of terrorism against Iraq and its people. Also, words of condemnation from leader of the National State Forces Alliance, Ammar al-Hakim, and neighboring Iran's Secretary of Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, has weighed in. He says the attack can be traced back to foreign think tanks creating and backing terrorist groups in Iraq, as well as foreign invading powers that have brought insecurity and division to the country. Now, we've also talked to political commentator Navid Behrouz, and he's put the situation into context for us, and he regards the attack as a possible effort to drive a wedge among political factions in Iraq.
Some people say that this attack is aimed at covering up on the violence during the protests, and they are people who would like to drive a wedge between political groups and the people, and actually the... Well, as Mr. Shamkhani also said, the target was to create a new sedition in Iraq, and that was the aim, and they want to those behind this attack, they were, as he said, could be traced back to foreign think tanks, as Mr. Shamkhani said. And they are the masterminds behind this. So we have had different reactions to this so far.
Israeli Prime Minister says that the regime would oppose the reopening of the U.S. consulate for Palestinians in Al-Quds.
There's so much more we agree upon with our American friends than we disagree upon. But indeed, our position is, and it was presented very clearly and openly to our American friends that there's no room for another American consulate in Jerusalem.
Naftali Bennett suggested that such a mission should be opened elsewhere in the occupied West Bank. The consulate was shut and merged with a U.S. embassy under former President Donald Trump in 2018. The Trump administration also recognized Al-Quds as Israel's capital and relocated the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to the illegally annexed city. That has sparked outrage among Palestinians who deem Al-Quds the capital of their future Palestinian state. In the meantime, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a protest rally in front of the Red Cross office, and that's in solidarity with Palestinian inmates who are on a hunger strike for more than 100 days. Ruba Shabat has the story.
The Prisoners Committee in the Gaza Strip held a rally in front of the Red Cross headquarters for the fourth consecutive day, protesting the Israeli illegal administrative detention policy practiced against Palestinian prisoners. This is part of a series of events held in the Gaza Strip in support of the prisoners whose health condition is deteriorating day by day due to their open-ended hunger strike.
We are here to send this clear message to our brothers and sisters in Israeli jails that we are proud of them for their resistance. There must be an end to their suffering. They have endangered their lives for the Palestinian cause, and now it is our duty to stand by them.
The protest comes as an Israeli court has reactivated its administrative detention order against Palestinian prisoner Miqdad al-Qawasmi, who has been on a hunger strike for over 100 days.
We hold Israel accountable for the lives of our inmates. The resistance front is closely monitoring the situation. Israel will pay a heavy price for its brutal behavior. The international community must be committed to its duties before it's too late.
In October, Qawasmi was admitted to the intensive care unit in Kaplan Medical Center following a deterioration in his health condition. The Israeli regime transferred him to a prison clinic, submitting false reports about his health conditions. At present, around 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are reportedly held in Israeli jails, including 200 children and 36 women. Of that number, 500 prisoners are in administrative detention. The policy of administrative detention allows Israeli authorities to extend the detention of a prisoner without charge or trial. Al-Qawasmi's health has been deteriorating as he is on the edge of death. However, the Israeli court has renewed his administrative detention with no charge. Six more Palestinian inmates are on hunger strike inside Israeli jails, suffering a critical health condition amid the silence of the international community. Ruba Shabat, Gaza.
Now, elsewhere in the world, in France, yellow vests continue to shine a light on the unpopularity of President Emmanuel Macron. Convictions in his biggest corruption scandal are now coming down, and yellow vests say that lenient punishment for allies of Macron is another example of why they are protesting. Rami Mazahari has more from Paris.
France's yellow vests continue to march nationwide, and just after a key conviction came down in the so-called Ben Alla affair. President Emmanuel Macron's former deputy chief of staff, Alexandre Ben Alla, will avoid serving any prison time even after being videotaped and convicted of beating male and female protesters while impersonating a police officer in 2018. For yellow vests, it's more proof that when it comes to hurting protesters, the country's executive, legislative, and judicial branches are not going to step in to protect the safety or rights of those who protest government policies in France.
It's an awful sentencing, just awful. Ben Alla should have to spend many years in jail, and certainly not just 1 year of house arrest. The interior minister who has guided all the repression against the yellow vests and who permanently handicapped so many people should be in prison for twice as long as Ben Alla.
While the Ben Alla affair hasn't resonated much outside of France, domestically, it's been Macron's most infamous scandal. A report from the French Senate declared that Macron showed, quote, incomprehensible indulgence towards the then 27-year-old Ben Alla, and the two appeared exceptionally close. The videotapes of Ben Alla were allegedly first leaked not by regular citizens, but by the National Security Services, which then sparked calls of a previously unmentioned deep state in France. The mysterious and ever-deepening scandal forced ministers to resign and caused Macron's popularity to drop, from which it has never recovered.
As usual, no prison for the rich. Everything goes fine for them. They never know hunger or poverty, but put everything on the average person's back. Benalla should have been treated like anyone else. Justice should be equal for everyone.
Many across France also protested because French lawmakers just approved extending the use of a COVID pass until after the presidential and legislative elections next spring. The pass is needed to do seemingly anything except to shop for food, and many wonder if it will be used to exclude people from voting. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
U.S. lawmakers recently approved legislation calling for more sanctions to ratchet up pressure against Nicaragua. And that comes just ahead of the country's presidential election, where incumbent President Daniel Ortega is expected to win a fourth term. Our correspondent Ahmed Kabbalah has more with his report from Managua.
United States imposes unilateral economic coercive measures on 29 countries and territories around the world. Nicaragua is already firmly on this list, but the most recent wave of sanctions approved by US lawmakers on the 3rd of November, just 4 days before the country heads into presidential elections, has been seen by international observers and solidarity activists as an attempt to influence the electoral process. There are six candidates competing for the Nicaraguan presidency on Sunday, with President Daniel Ortega highly probable to win according to voting intention polls, with achievements related to social programs and economic growth explaining why voters are likely to re-elect the leader of the Sandinista movement. We visit a social housing program where low-income families have been housed at government-subsidized costs to find out how the news related to the sanctions had been received.
The measures by the United States is an attempt to stop the government from implementing programs like this, which are extremely popular. And obviously, if the government has fewer funds, then it will be more difficult to keep investing in these types of programs.
To benefit from projects like this, it doesn't matter if you are Sandinista or not. This project is for all Nicaraguan citizens, irrespective of their political affiliation. The sanctions implemented by the United States are an attempt to hamper the political process here and weaken the country.
The fresh wave of sanctions are linked to the alleged jailing of political opponents. However, the Nicaraguan government has claimed that those who have been detained were key actors in the 2018 violence that led to the kidnapping, torture, and murder of Sandinista supporters and police officers. President Daniel Ortega has insisted that U.S. sanctions will not be allowed to get in the way of justice. Ahmed Kabbalah, Managua.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Could you tell a little about yourself? Amerik Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who is taught me the art of
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful rainy Sunday, November 7th, 2021. I'm Atefa Erfani hosting this program today. Listeners Special is a Sunday program where your views are read and presented through emails, letters, and messages. So contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. If you have any messages for our listeners around the world, then record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard. Remember, Listeners Special is the Sunday program, is your program, so it's your views that are important. Keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, the Sunday program, actually your program. As usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. As you may know, these reception reports are very helpful and important to us because they enable our technicians and engineers to provide a better service, a high-quality service, to our dear listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an EQSL card from us. And here I truly appreciate those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Arthur Fernandez Lorella from Spain, Christian Ivanaj from Italy, and Don Glocka from the US. So Arthur, Christian, and Don, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRB English Radio. And a million thanks to those of our great listeners who have kindly sent us letters and emails from around the world, which I mentioned some of their names here, and later during the program, I will read their emails or letters. Here we have an email from Habib Klisli from Turkey, who has sent us an email. Habib, we have an email from Ge Hoybens from the Netherlands. I wish I'm right in pronouncing his names because I don't know Dutch. And here we have an email from Slovakia. This email is from Alexandra Bogdanova. And from Hungary, we have an email from one of our regular listeners, from Mata Holosi. And the last but not the least is an email from Robens Pedroso from Brazil. Robens is one of our regular listeners. Dear listeners of Listeners Special, please keep us company until the end of the program. I will be back with these kind letters and emails from around the world. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and we have so many letters and emails from around the world. As I said, Habib Klisli from Turkey has sent us an email. Habib says, the only way to deal with the criminal USA is to deal with them with decisiveness. I'm so happy that the Iranian forces dealt with the American mercenaries in the Persian Gulf promptly and decisively. So please show them a lesson that they don't dare come back to the region again. Salam and warm greetings to you, Habib, from Turkey. Many thanks for sending us this email, and it's great that you care about the global developments, especially the developments happening in the West Asia region. As you said, actually, Iran have to deal with the issue with decisiveness, and as the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC's chief said, the United States is accustomed them to suffering defeat after defeat from Iran, but has yet to learn a lesson. As you may know, the Americans are used to constantly suffering defeats at the hands of the Iranian people, but of course, this has not yet become a lesson for them. The decline of the United States of America has just begun, and on the contrary, we have increasingly been boosting political vitality and revolutionary enthusiasm, and our establishment has been reaching higher levels of power day by day, thank God. Anyway, Habib Kılıçlı from Turkey, many thanks for sending us this email, and many thanks for showing your thoughtfulness and your care and concern about the global developments, especially those happening in the West Asia region. Write to us soon and tell us more about the world developments, of course, and of course about the IRB English radio programs. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon, Habib from Turkey. And as I said, from the Netherlands, we have an email from Ge Hoijbens from the Netherlands. As I said, I wish I'm pronouncing in his or her names. Anyway, Ge says, hello, IRB English radio staff. Many thanks for the nice EQSL verification that I received from you. I will keep listening to your radio and will send you my reception report. Greetings from the Netherlands. Salam and warm greetings to you, Geh from the Netherlands, and many thanks for sending us this email. And we are so happy that you enjoyed the EQSL card my colleague sent to you. That's great. So you keep listening to IRB English Radio, and that's great. My colleagues, of course, will soon send you an EQSL card. Write to us soon. And Geoff from the Netherlands, why don't you tell us your views about our programs? Tell us which program or programs you like the best. Thank you for sending us this email. So after a short break, I will be back with an email from Slovakia. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. Alexandra Bogdanova from Slovakia has sent us an email. Alexandra says, greetings. I have sent you my reception report for the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The broadcast was good and understandable. It was also audible. The signal strength was stable and most of the time unchanging. During the whole time I was listening, the audio was followed by one monotonous tone, most likely from another station. If you found this report useful, I would very much appreciate an EQSL card sent to my address. With best wishes, stay safe. Salam and warm greetings to you, Alexandra Bogdanova from Slovakia, and I sent my deepest appreciations to you for sending us this email. It was great. You know, you just described the quality of our programs in detail. As you said, the broadcast was good and understandable, and it was audible. The signal strength was stable, as you said. But you said there was a trouble, and the audio was followed by one monotonous tone, most likely from another station. Of course, we will refer to our technicians and engineers about this problem, but in general, it was great. reflecting your views about the quality of our programs. I mean, of course, my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card. Many thanks for sending us this email. Let this mutual relationship continue. Keep on listening to IRIB English Radio and write to us soon and tell us your views about the programs of IRIB English Radio. Alexandra Bogdanova from Slovakia. Thank you. From Hungary, we have an email from one of our regular listeners, from Mata Holosi. Mata Holosi from Hungary says, "Dear IRIB English Radio staff, I'm writing to you in order to share my reception report from the city of Debrecen, Hungary. After several failed attempts to tune in to your station because of bad weather, I was finally able to hear your radio station. If I might have a chance for a recommendation, please raise the volume, because unfortunately I hear other noises as well. If you think that my report was helpful and correct, I would very much like a QSL card sent to my address." Salam and warm greetings to you, Mata Holosi from Hungary. Thank you very much for sending us this email and, of course, sharing your views about the quality of our programs. After several failed attempts, you finally tuned into IRIB English Radio, and that was great. My colleagues will soon, refer to this problem, as you said, raising the volume. They will fix the problem and raise the volume so that other voices and other noises could not be heard. Thank you for telling us your view about this problem. And my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card, because sending paper QSL cards is not possible because we are in the time of pandemic and we have to obey the rules and regulations of the national, mail system. Anyway, Mata Holosi from Hungary, thank you very much for sending us this email. We're looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And after a short break, I will be back with an email from Brazil from Robens Pedroso. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. As I said, we have received an email from Robens Pedroso from Brazil, one of our regular listeners, of course. Robens says, "Dear friends at the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, I have had the pleasure of listening to your station during its transmission. I'm 50 years old. I will be grateful if you send me a paper QSL card. Verifying my reception report. Would you please send me a letter or a card which confirms that I have really heard your station? Thank you in advance." Salam and warm greetings to you, Robens Pedroso from Brazil, and thank you very much for sending this email to your radio, IRIB English Radio. My colleagues can send you paper QSL cards or a palpable thing, actually a promotional item, because we are in the time of pandemic, but they will soon send you an EQSL card, and it's a pleasure to have you with us. Tell us your views about our programs in your upcoming emails or letters, and then we will soon send you an EQSL card. Robens Pedroso from Brazil, stay with us, please. Thank you. And before we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special, I appreciate those of our great listeners who have sent us emails and letters from around the world, and of course reception reports, including Habib Klishli from Turkey, Ge Hojbens from the Netherlands, Alexandra Bogdanova from Slovakia, Mata Holosi from Hungary, Robens Pedroso from Brazil, and of course Artur Fernandez, Lorella from Spain, Kristen Ivanovic from Italy, and Dan Glocka from the US. Many thanks for being with us, and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to englishradio@irib.ir. That is one word, englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00982122013720. Once again, our phone number is 00982122013720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the case of Ahmed Arbery, the black American man who was jogging and killed by white men in southern Georgia last year, was not an anomaly in the United States. White men killing a black man while saying they thought the black man had broken the law has been happening as long as this country has existed. And now the trial of the three men involved in his killing is taking place in front of a practically all-white jury. Will stay with us as we take a look at this story on the Spotlight. I'd like to start it off crossing over to D.C. and talking to his correspondent, Wyatt Reed. Wyatt, thanks so much. Good to see you. Wyatt, tell us what's going on. So the trial is starting, and fill us in, please.
That's right. We have seen at least one day so far of argumentation, and as you correctly pointed out, due to what's called preemptory laws that affect how juries are drawn, we are seeing a jury that is almost entirely white, 11 out of 12 jurors who will decide the guilt of Ahmaud Arbery's killers are white. And this is partly to do with the fact that the judge allowed the prosecutors significantly fewer, about half as many attempts to dismiss jurors from the pool. So that is indeed, at least from an optic perspective, and really from a race perspective, more broadly, pretty disturbing in and of itself. What we know about the cases, Ahmaud Arbery was jogging a new Brunswick, Georgia neighborhood on February 23rd, 2020, when three men, Travis and the McMichaels, Gregory and Travis McMichael, father and son, as well as their friend who's filming this encounter, essentially chased Ahmaud Arbery with their vehicles, allegedly hit him with the vehicle, and then killed him with firearms, supposedly acting in self-defense. Ahmaud Arbery was not armed. The men who were responsible were not arrested. And in fact, it was only until 2 months later, it was only 2 months later when video of the event surfaced that anything was done at all. So as you can see, this is another case in which really justice for the victim of another racial killing seems to be the kind of thing that's very hard fought and not forthcoming unless it's something the family members are willing to fight for.
All right, thanks so much for that update. Out of Washington, D.C., Wyatt Reed. Well, I'd like to welcome our guests to this spotlight. Social activist and senior pastor, Reverend Graylin Hagler, out of Washington, D.C. And writer and journalist, Abayomi Azakiwi, out of Detroit.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us, Reverend Hagler. Good to see you again. Reverend Hagler, I mean, it is hard for some people who really have never lived in the United States or really cannot understand to fathom that in 2020, a black man could be jogging, not doing anything in a white neighborhood and killed simply because he was black in an all-white neighborhood. I mean, try to break it down for our international audience who perhaps really cannot relate to what this means.
Well, that's part of the history of the United States. There were sundown towns. When I say sundown towns, there were towns where if you were black or a person of color, you couldn't be in after sundown. And that continued to exist basically all the way through the Civil Rights Movement. And even to a great extent right now, because I remember even when I was in Chicago, and I used to drive over to a suburb just next outside of Chicago. I used to get pulled over by cops all the time for no reason and questioned. So that's a continued pattern in the United States where whites want to live in segregated neighborhoods that are insulated and isolated from anybody else. And will when they see anybody else, usually they put it in the category of that they're there to steal, there to kill, there to maim. And so they really think that they have to defend themselves even against a defenseless, unarmed jogger.
Well, let me cross over to Detroit, talk to Abayomi again. Thanks so much for being with us. When we look at the situation, what Reverend Hagler just said, that simply just being in that neighborhood, a black person, it's many times it's just assumed that he's done something. He's committed a crime. And we saw in this case, too, these three white men basically said that they thought that he had committed a crime. I mean, talk about this mindset and how we got here, because I really do feel that for people who have not lived in the United States and some of these other countries, it may be a little bit difficult if they haven't seen this themselves, this breakdown in racism, so sharp and so evil, let us say.
Well, thank you for the invitation once again. And yeah, I think it goes back to the 2.5 centuries of enslavement of African people in the United States, where we were considered property, and we were to be contained and controlled, exploited, and oppressed. And even after the Civil War and the legal abolition of slavery, that is still the mindset of law enforcement, as well as a lot of whites who feel that African Americans have no right to be in certain areas. And even in their own communities, they are subject to stop and frisk and other forms of harassment. I mean, these three white men had no right whatsoever to ask Ahmed Arbery to stop. I mean, this is not the period of enslavement. They just say, oh, hey, black man, halt, halt. No, they have no right to say that. And he had no weapons. He had no property on him. He was jogging. Just because you stop to look at a construction site doesn't mean that your intentions is to commit a robbery. So this is totally an outrageous, fabricated defense that they're coming up with. And I think the jury selection process, which the judge commented on during the opening arguments in order to cover himself, but he could have, and he said he couldn't, he could have declared, a mistrial. They could have started over with the impanelment of a jury that was more representative. I mean, it's going to be very difficult. We hope that these majority white panel will reach a just decision, but it's going to be extremely difficult for the prosecution to argue that these three white men were not justified in killing this African-American man.
Well, stop right there, Bayomi. You just said something. Because, of course, we know that it's only one black man on the jury, 11 others white. And you said it would be hard to get justice or hard, to this case to be judged fairly. Does it mean that people will not look at the evidence in the case and just basically judge this based on color only?
It happens all the time. Just on Press TV earlier this week, it was a report about a study that was done by the New York Times that indicated that 400 people have been killed in routine traffic stops over the last 5 years in the United States. So they're operating with a bias that any black person, woman or man, youth or adult or senior citizen is suspect. So anything they do to you is justified, and they can rationalize that they felt threatened by your presence, by your refusal to cooperate with their commands. So this is a major problem right now in the United States, and no matter how much the government says that we cannot defund the police, we cannot dismantle law enforcement in this country, it has to happen in order for justice to be served in these type of cases and in thousands upon thousands of other cases that are ongoing right now in the United States.
Reverend Hagler, this murder took place in Georgia, and is it that the South is more racist than the North, or is this something that could have happened anywhere in the United States? I mean, does it make a difference?
Well, it's something that could happen anywhere. I mean, Minnesota's in the North, Georgia's in the South. George Floyd was killed in Minnesota, and Arbery was killed in Georgia. It doesn't matter whether it is North or South, but because there's a mentality that exists. And the other guest is just raising the issue exactly correctly. As he talks about, really, there's a pervasive structure in America that racism is built into it. Now, for the average white person in the United States of America, they have a very hard time seeing racism. They call it, and they've gotten conditioned to call it everything else. From being conservative to being to the right, all of those other types of things. But it's actually racist when the groups like the Conservative Political Action Committee meets. That's made up of all of the white supremacist groups in America, including the Republican Party. But folks do not see it as racism or as racist. They see it as basically conservatism. That's what exists. So to be able to talk about in the Aubrey case that somehow race was a motivating factor that caused these three white men to break out there and kill Aubrey is hard for white America to see. It's hard for white America to understand. Just like you're talking about, it's hard for the world to understand the fabric of America. It's hard for white Americans to understand what racism looks like, the impact it has, the effect it has, and the fact that it is also put in place and maintained through laws and rules so that whites remain in power as the dominant culture and basically can lock up and kill black folks or brown folks.
Abiyomi, we saw mass protests in the U.S. last year against racism and police violence. Nothing has changed, but we have not seen those same types of rallies this year. Now, many say that racism was used to pressure the Trump regime, not to really make a difference in the racist actions in the U.S. Your thoughts on that?
Well, yes. The election of the current administration of Joe Biden was in large part in response to the mass demonstrations that took place in the aftermath of the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and of course George Floyd, and many others who were killed during 2020. And some people felt with the election of Joe Biden that things would change. Unfortunately, they have not changed. And a clear indication of it is that the failure of the U.S. Congress to pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act earlier this year indicates that they have no intentions of reining in the police or defunding the police or restructuring the whole concept of public safety in the United States. So people are going to have to go back out into the streets. They're going to have to assess where we are right now as a country in order to move forward effectively, because the police are the first line of defense for the ruling class in this country, which is racist, and they feel they have to strengthen law enforcement in order to maintain the status quo.
Reverend Hagler, are black people any safer today than they were, let's say, 20 years ago, 100 years ago? How would you compare?
They're probably a little safer than 100 years ago. But 20 years ago, I'm not so sure. Because what I continue to see and what we continue to see are things like illegal police actions, extrajudicial killings. We see the courts being filled and overloaded with black people. The jails are overflowing and loaded with black people. So we see the same type of oppression that continues to go on and on and on.
So why do you say they perhaps were safer 100 years ago?
No, I didn't say we were safer 100 years ago. I said we're safer today than 100 years ago because 100 years ago, in fact, in Red Summer, 1918, towns and hamlets were burnt down, disappeared, people were killed in mass. Tulsa, Oklahoma, 1921, whole town was burnt down, people were killed in mass. 1898, in Wilmington, North Carolina, there was a coup d'etat launched against the elected town council, and the town council was assassinated, and whites put themselves in power, back in power. So that's what I'm saying, that there was a difference in terms of you could do that with impunity, and you had no repercussions, you had no video cameras in order to record it, you had virtually no reaction from anybody,
right,
including the Justice Department, the U.S. government, or even from the citizens who basically had to cower in fear. It is a little bit different today. Thank God we can get to the street. Thank God we can demonstrate. Thank God we can declare Black Lives Matter. Thank God we can do all of that, still under great risk, great fear of going to jail for a lot of folks, but we can still get out there and do it and come together and be united as a people and as a community.
Abiyomi, the problem with racism is critical in the U.S. to the extent that there are growing talks of secession. Racism has been a problem since the beginning of these United States of America. Do you think the division of this country could resolve or at least lessen the problem?
I think it could lessen the problem. The difficulty is that there's so much invested in the oppression of African Americans and other people of color that it's actually to the benefit of the ruling class to continue the status quo. If we talk about 100 years ago, what happened in Tulsa, in 1919, there was also a riot, so-called riot. Actually, it was a massacre of 300 African-Americans in Arkansas, whose only crime was they attempted to form a sharecroppers union to get adequate compensation for the growing and selling of their crops. This was their crime, and they were attacked by a white mob, including law enforcement, and 200 to 300 people were killed. Ida B. Wells Barnett wrote a book called The Arkansas Riot of 1919. It's chilling to read that book. But today, people are still being gunned down in the streets. And moreover, if you look at the criminal justice system, the majority of people who are in prison in this country are black and brown people. And an even larger majority are black, brown, working class, and poor people. There are virtually no billionaires in the prisons, no billionaires on death row in this country. So even though they may not have the lynch mobs that they had in 1919 and in 1921 and in other years, the police, the courts, the prosecutors, and the corporate media essentially plays the same role as the lynch mobs. They put people in conditions in which they can be arrested, and then after they're arrested, they're railroaded through the courts, they're put into the criminal justice system, even after they get out of prison. It's very difficult for people to even find housing, to find employment. So the problem is still here.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Hagler, what would you say? There are many who say that actually black Americans, African Americans, were better off during segregation than after integration. During segregation, there were many vibrant black businesses, black doctors, all type of activities in the black communities. And the dollar actually stayed in the black community much longer than it does today. I mean, what would you say to that?
Well, to some degree, that's absolutely correct in terms of economics, and that the community actually did business with itself, was forced into doing business with itself. But also at the same time, the black community was denied political power, was denied representation in elected offices, the right to vote, all of those other things, as well as tax processes that were put in place to penalize black people for owning land, even for being engaged in business. So even though segregation sort of benefited to some degree a black community, it also disempowered that black community as well, politically as well as economically. So you got to look at it in terms of both sides of that coin, the benefit of that one side and also the negative abilities of the other side of the coin.
And Abu Yomi, where do you see the United States headed? I mean, the country seems more divided than ever. Is there light at the end of the tunnel or on the horizon? Or do you see a continual deterioration in race relations in that country?
It appears to be a continuous deterioration. We look what happened on January 6th. It was interesting Reverend Hagler mentioned the Wilmington coup in 1898. These people in Washington attempted a national coup. Although it failed, they're using different tactics by drafting new laws to prevent African Americans and other people of color from voting in states around the country. They're doing all types of activity on a legal basis to accomplish the same task that they could not carry out on January the 6th. So I think the country potentially could be in for another civil war. But I think the task of the activists and the progressives is to take that civil war and try to turn it into a revolutionary war, to actually change the society from the bottom up. I think that is the real only solution that we have.
Okay, and on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on the Spotlight. Senior pastor and social activist, Graylin Hagler, out of Washington, D.C., and writer and journalist, Abu Yomi Azikiwe, out of Detroit. And as always, appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio.